everybody, and welcome to Tag Lab, where we are looking for interesting stories of personal growth and development mixed with a healthy dose of technology and digital insight. So today I am really excited to have Rob Smallwood with us, who is head of industry and media agencies at Meta. So huge welcome to you, Rob. So happy to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Laura.
Amazing. And Rob and I met through Meta, who are one of our key partners, and he's been so supportive of us as an agency and always has loads of fresh ideas and really good insights on what's happening in the market. And I think having those partner relationships are something that we are eternally grateful for. So delighted to have him here today. So if we can kick off, Rob, and you tell us a bit about your journey and where you got to and how did you end up at Meta and a bit more about the marketing journey to date.
Sure, happy to. And again, it's great to be here. So if we go kind of back a little bit, I was kind of always obsessed with movies and film and kind of mucking about trying to make them at home. I did media at A-level. I did film at university. So I guess I've always been kind of really interested in storytelling and the art and craft of telling stories. And obviously marketing is exactly that. How do we tell really compelling, inspiring brand and product stories to capture people's attention and ultimately make them care about brands and businesses? So I started my career post university. I didn't go into film. I hasten to add, but I did go into kind of broadcast media. So started my career in radio, in audio, and really enjoyed the challenge of kind of explaining to clients how to tell stories through audio. Obviously, it's slightly more challenging without the visuals, but learned a lot in that industry. And then moved into digital, joined The Guardian within the digital team, and joined at a really interesting time as they were transforming their entire business to be digital first. So I was pleased to be involved in that and learned a huge amount about publishing and how to lean into what was then, you know, lauded as the open web, and publishing was an exciting place to be at that time. And then, you know, having spent a good 7 years there, I decided to move into tech and into social. So joined what was Facebook then. Feels like a dramatically different place to the one I'm kind of sitting in at the minute. But yeah, I've learned a huge amount about the wider marketing ecosystem from kind of traditional and digital media into where I am today, which touches commerce, touches kind of social marketing, influencer, brand performance, the full gamut of everything you can kind of do within marketing. So I feel like my journey has kind of very much evolved. I've worked in many different sort of disciplines, but that kind of the red thread of telling really interesting stories to consumers is always been kind of there. And in something that I'm still very passionate and enthused about. So yeah, that's my kind of my potted history, starting very much in an aspirational desire to be actually a screenwriter. And, you know, I've still got a couple of unfilmed scripts lying around if you're interested.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, not to be, but yeah, fascinated with this industry and continue to be thrilled at its potential as we evolve.
Absolutely. And we look forward to seeing some of those films. I'm sure you'll manage that as a side project. I saw an interesting post that you had that was data wins arguments, but stories are what changes people's minds, or words to that effect. Can you talk just a little bit about how you bring that into your role now? Because I think that's where you've got a huge amount of there's data and everything's machine learning and powered by the algorithms, but ultimately it's the stories and what's memorable that sticks with people and actually changes the consumer's mind. So can you talk a little bit to that?
Yeah, I think there's, and this is something we've been thinking quite a lot about recently, because our business is kind of built on obviously data and the respectful and thoughtful use of that data. And obviously that in itself has changed over the last couple of years as more regulation and changes in consumer expectations have evolved as well. But ultimately, you know, our business is grounded on data and makes a lot of decisions based on the data that we see coming in from both how people are enjoying and engaging in our apps. And again, we evolve our products based on how people are leaning into different surfaces or watching certain types of video, and kind of Reels is a good example of how we've seen this behavior both on and off platforms evolve, and we've really lent in and tried to develop a consumer experience that is grounded in that data. But from a kind of a business perspective, I think there's, I guess, two things we're thinking of. The first of which is how do we tell a really compelling story to our business about, you know, the outside marketing world, because many people who work at Meta don't intersect with advertising and marketing at all. You know, we're very much a product tech led business. But also, how do we translate our business, which is incredibly complicated, to the outside world? You know, how do we form a compelling narrative around what you can get done through our services to the benefit of businesses and marketers, but one that makes sense? Because we are, you know, we talk about this kind of fire hose of information internally, because there is just, you know, there's just so much going on. But how do we help people outside the company understand how to use the platform and how to use it to the benefit of their business is not an easy thing to do. So, and I think sometimes we've lent in, I think rightfully so, around building evidence to support our story, right? You know, we want to make sure that everyone who invests money with us gets a return, and a really positive return. So we've invested a huge amount in building the evidence around our platform. Now, I think, you know, and this is perhaps an uncomfortable conversation, but sometimes people just don't want to believe the evidence. Some people have kind of quite baked in ideas around our platform sometimes, and sometimes, despite the wealth of evidence that's been produced, particularly third-party evidence, people still don't want to believe it. So I think that makes me think, well, you know, we're all humans, right? We all have irrational moments. Sometimes data can't win arguments. Sometimes we've got to be better at crafting an emotional story, and one that kind of speaks to people's instincts and intuitions, as well as it being heavily grounded in data. So that's our general thinking for this year, is that how do we tell a more compelling story that is grounded in data and evidence, but also appeals to people's emotions and instincts, so that we don't get this cognitive dissonance that I think sometimes arises when we speak to clients and agencies, that, you know, I get that you've got the data, but I just don't believe it. It just doesn't ring true to me. So that's the kind of the gap that I guess we've got to bridge, and telling interesting stories is a good way, I think, to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what people remember ultimately. So you can put all of the numbers and the way that we're going to position something, but ultimately it's like, how is that making people feel, and what's memorable when you've got whatever it is, 5,000 messages that we see a day, you know, there's only one or two things, that kind of mental availability that your users and your clients have. It's got to be the stuff that's sticky, like you say. So yeah, you can have all the numbers, but the stories have got to be compelling. So yeah, absolutely agree with you on that. And I always think that, you know, there's so much that you guys are testing all the time, and not everything is going to stick. And that's part of the culture, you know, is like innovate and test things. And, you know, we go with the stuff that works, which is, you know, how we try and run as a business as well. So yeah, finding the stuff that sticks. So as head of industry, you have lots of people-based relationships with agencies and media buyers and all of these companies. How does that relationship evolve with so much automation coming in? Where do you see that going over the next couple of years, and where are you kind of focusing your time in terms of customer value add, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a fascinating topic to get into, because obviously our kind of general, I think the industry's general trajectory is one of increased automation based on, you know, advancements in kind of AI. And that is what we're focused on, and that's what many other companies are also focused on, both of whom are building their own AI infrastructure, but also leaning on existing tools as well. You know, I've just come from an event this morning where a client was talking about, you know, leveraging OpenAI and Midjourney and all these freely available tools, and everyone's trying to wrestle with the right application of those automated tools for their business. And it's obviously no one's got a blueprint. We're all figuring this out as we go. And I think from our perspective, I guess, again, there's an internal and external application for how we're thinking about this. We're trying to, you know, a lot of people talk about AI from an efficiency play, and there's obviously a clearly an efficiency angle to it. But I think we're trying to certainly internally think about how it can augment what we're doing as a business. And I think a lot of the fear and concern is around AI replacing people and skills and work. But I think we're really trying to reframe that around how it can augment existing existing practices and kind of the jobs to be done. So internally, we're trying to develop, you know, tools to help us be more efficient and be better at our jobs, with a view to helping us all concentrate on the things that AI can't get near at the minute. And, you know, that's the kind of strategic, the creative, the imagination, the persuasive, you know, elements, which I think us as people are just, you know, uniquely positioned to do. And then from an external point of view, we are speaking to clients and agencies about this, you know, this automated journey, which it is, you know, this is an iterative process, and helping people understand that, look, there's no going back with some of this stuff. There is ways in which, you know, AI and some of our new machine learning models can better automate and optimize campaign performance than any human can possibly do, right? We're not going to go back to that, much like many of the technological advancements have been made around other industries. There is just no going back. So there's this whole change management thing around helping people understand that some things are best to be automated. That's certainly our view in certainly our ad product. But that does not mean there's not a wealth of jobs to be done around this kind of automated system. So, I mean, I'm incredibly bullish on the future of our industry and the future of agencies within that industry as well, because while a lot will be automated by, you know, our system, that just changes the jobs to be done. You know, understanding the data strategy for a given client, understanding how to leverage their competitive advantage with their own unique data is a complicated subject. It's one that touches on legal aspects, on consent. It touches on, you know, the right appropriate use of data. But that's a really meaty thing to get hold of. And all of that data that any given client on agencies role within that can supercharge this automated system. So that's a really meaningful piece of work. Then you've got kind of all, what does this mean for creative and kind of media planning as well? And that's still to be decided, but there's a huge amount of people thinking about, well, how do we set up the right frameworks for creative? How do we get the right diversification? How do we get the right inputs again that can feed this automated system to supercharge results? And then you've got the other side, which is how do we understand what's working, what's not, and why? Setting up the kind of the measurement frameworks and getting into the weeds of different strategies playing out and understanding how this is working alongside other channels, right? You know, there's some really, like, really difficult things to try and get a hold of there. And then, you know, we all want to make sure that we're delivering best practice. You know, what are the signals? And how do we codify that? You know, there's a huge amount that you know, we don't yet know about what's working, what's not. And this is always going to change. That's the thing. Once you've built the blueprint, something will undoubtedly change moving forward. So you're going to have to review and constantly iterate. So it's an ever moving feast. And while, again, this centralized function around the system is going to be more automated, the kind of the human ingenuity and imagination needs to exist at either side of it, I think, to really leverage and supercharge that system. That's where there's a huge amount of value to be added. That's a huge amount of competitive advantage to be gained as well. So we're trying to help, I guess, clients and agencies understand that there is, you know, there's some really complicated work to be done, and we're going to need everyone's help to kind of understand how best to do it. That's externally. And then internally as well, we're just trying to find ways in which automation can help people do better work, more enjoyable work as well, more work that we want to spend time doing. We talk a lot about strengths at Meta, you know, work that you're not only good at, but work that really, you know, gives you energy. So the more time we can get people doing work that gives them energy, that makes them, you know, brings them joy, that's the good stuff. And if we can automate the stuff that is probably less enjoyable, then that hopefully is good for everyone.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think we are, you know, we've seen this happen multiple times throughout history. You know, when we think about like scientific calculators coming out or search engines coming out, there's this kind of panic initially because there's going to be some form of displacement. But like you say, it's how do we keep upskilling ourselves and our teams? And I heard something this morning that was, take your worst skill and give it to AI and AI will complete it about 80% of what a kind of industry expert could do. So I think when you look at it through that lens, you are able to take away a lot of the mundane tasks and the repetitive stuff that you do and then upskill. So you've got more time for the idea creation, which we're not going to see AI kind of come up with initially. The strategic piece, the human connection, education, customer service, all of that good stuff, I think is hugely exciting. And I see where that's where a lot of the value is going to come from. So yeah, totally agree.
And I think that's kind of probably at the heart of some of this concern, right? If you ask someone, what would you want to automate about your life or your job? I'm sure they'd give you a long list of stuff they don't want to do and they wish they could automate. But because this is moving into a space where AI is able to do some of the stuff that I guess we really love and we really enjoy and we feel is kind of more uniquely human, you know, as you get into the creative space, as we get to this you know, this idea of general intelligence as well, that makes us feel more uncomfortable because that's where we feel defensive and at risk. But again, that's why I think we try and think about how we augment as opposed to how we place to replace. Yeah. And to your point around connection as well, I think this is one of the things that is most misunderstood about some of our longer term vision around the metaverse, and obviously AI is going to underpin that, is that we want to try and replace human connection in real life. That couldn't be further. There is nothing better than meeting people in real life and connecting as people. Obviously we're speaking over the internet, over using technology, and this is good, but this could be even better if I had a hologram of you projected over the table I'm sat with, or we were in, you know, photorealistic avatars and engaging that way. You know, there is ways in which technology can make this sort of thing better, but that doesn't mean it needs to replace it. It's just, it's highly convenient that we can do this and not be in the same room, right? That's just an efficiency. So I think how AI can help us, you know, spend more time doing the stuff we enjoy. And again, being with people, you know, this is a relationship business. You know, people buy from people, people sell to people. I don't think we're ever going to be a successful company if we try and get everyone to interface with some kind of AI agent. That's not going to be a very rewarding way to intersect with our company. Unless in the future it's just an AI talking to an AI, and that could well happen, but certainly not in the medium term. I don't see that.
We had some of your colleagues speak at our event in Dubai, Digitex, and she was talking about using the MetaQuest. She was going to a Coldplay concert in Dubai that was completely sold out. You weren't able to go, but you could attend virtually. So she attended, and then her friend was right next to her. So the two of them got to be right next to each other, having this virtual experience that she wasn't able to do anyway because the concert was sold out. So like you say, it can kind of add something to your life that's not replacing it. She was never able to do it, but she still had this amazing experience dancing and singing next to her friend by using MetaQuest. And we had great fun actually last Friday in the office with it, with everybody walking the plank, going on roller coasters. And it was a really silly thing, and we did it as part of comic relief, but actually you were using a virtual experience in an in-person setting, so it's not as binary as you think. You know, that you have this very removed, remote experience. I think the two can blend together and actually create a really unique experience for people to come together. So I think it's having that open mindset of like, what does that actually look like? And it's not this thing to be fearful of, but in general, we do fear change. You know, that's kind of the default emotion that people go to. And some of the jobs that will be done, we don't know what those jobs are. And it's that fear of the unknown that creates the panic. So I think it's a journey. And probably a lot of the predictions that we've got now will be completely wrong. And we'll look back and really laugh at the stuff that we thought. And yeah, hugely excited to see what happens next in this space. So moving on to talking a little bit more about short form content. So you touched on Reels, and where do you see, or how is Meta really positioning itself to leverage that short form content, and what opportunities are there for creators and then after that advertisers within the space?
Yeah, I think, I mean, short form, and again, that means Reels primarily for us, is just something that's kind of taking the industry by storm. And obviously this isn't something that we have necessarily led from the get-go, but something that we're, again, a trend that we observed and thought would be valuable to bring to our services. And it has. I mean, that's the thing around understanding, again, being very people-centered, consumer-focused, is adapting and making sure we are ever evolving our services to match their needs and their expectations. And short form video is something that, again, is just absolutely exploded. And I think Reels as an example, which is not Instagram only, it's Facebook, it's across different parts of our ecosystem. It's really just caught people's attention because it's appealing to a different kind of content. It's kind of it's engaging, it's funny, it's relatable, it's very creator centric as well. So we are, you know, we've been trying to find the right spaces to help creators find an audience and ultimately make a living as well. And Reels has definitely helped supercharge that. And again, it's part of this kind of longer term, I guess, vision and strategy around the metaverse and spatial, is that we want to develop or be part of developing a kind of creator-led economy where, you know, anyone can have access to tools and technology to create work and connect with people that's meaningful. And certainly Reels is helping to do that. And again, we're not the only horse in town. And short form is prevalent across many, many different apps and products, platforms now. So that in and of itself is an interesting trend. And I think, you know, how we can help clients and agencies understand the opportunity is a fascinating one. We actually built a studio in our offices here in London to help clients and agencies understand what we call the language of Reels. So testing and experimenting. So we've got a bedroom, we've got a bathroom, we've got a games room, we've got all these different locations that we've kind of built as sets to help people understand how to get the best out of this format. And again, it's very much creator led. It's kind of digital creators in particular, both behind the camera and in front of the camera. So it's a really nascent but exploding part of our business. And I think, I guess, what's slightly different maybe for us is that Reels as a consumption is obviously, you know, gone absolutely nuts, but it's how people are sharing Reels, which is I think very interesting. You know, 3.5 billion Reels are shared every day, and it's through messaging. So the nature and different ways in which people are sharing within our ecosystem has fundamentally changed. It used to be all about feed and people sharing everyday moments and meaningful moments within their Facebook or Instagram. And then things have evolved to being, again, meeting the expectations of people to be more around ephemeral sharing as well. And that's why stories really caught fire. But now it's evolved again to be one of entertainment and, you know, authenticity. And that's where Reels is playing an important part. But people are sharing it privately through WhatsApp, through Instagram, through Messenger. So the way in which the content is being is spreading around our ecosystem has changed. So that's quite an interesting thing for us to consider, and a good one, I guess, longer term for brands to think about as well, as things like WhatsApp become more of a place for businesses as we evolve that product.
Yeah. And I think I read it was when it was Facebook's product, it was the fastest growing ad format Facebook ever, was rolled out in 150 countries, like was just, like you say, the speed was absolutely lightning. And I wonder, like, it's interesting to talk about how people are sharing and if it's kind of a bit of a similar type of idea to Royal Mail's campaign when they had kind of saw this and thought of you. There's something very personal and authentic when somebody shares a reel with you, because it's very much like, I saw this and I thought of you, it reminded me of you. So again, it's kind of bringing that technological plus human element together into something that's really personalized. So I think it builds that behavior and makes people feel special. And ultimately that's, you know, what everyone is looking for is to be seen. And I think Reels actually does that in quite a unique way.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that's, again, we were having this conversation last week around social media being a very personalized, way of consuming content, whereas other kind of, I guess, more broadcast or traditional media is kind of more of a shared experience. But I think this is a good intersection between the two, which is, you know, all nearly, you know, nearly 4 billion people in our around the world use one of our apps or services. And that's 4 billion different types of feeds, right? They're all uniquely created every time you open the app. But being able to share in that kind of personalized feed with others through, again, parts, you know, like WhatsApp or those close community groups you have, which is where all the sharing happens now, right? You know, family groups, we're all in way too many WhatsApp groups, I'm sure. But sharing those contents that have been created for you, but sharing them with personal groups is something that's definitely people are enjoying. And I say it all the time, you know, exchanging funny little things with individuals that, like you say, you might find a common joke, or just into other groups where, you know, you think it might land with. And it's that idea of like, well, who would like this and who can I share this experience with, I think is interesting. And again, as we move towards this other future where, you know, if you think about VR right now, that's a very singular experience. Obviously, you can connect to other people via different games and stuff, but it still feels quite, it's a non-shared experience. As you get into more mixed reality and augmented reality and the technology develops there, there's going to be this more of a shared experience as well, where multiple people can be involved in the same thing, augmented by technology. So again, it feels like that's where certainly our business is headed, this intersection of the technology improving and connection and bringing people together around a shared experience. And that's kind of at the heart of our business.
Do you see that kind of mixed reality future starting, or maybe it's intended to replace more linear TV and broadcast channels? Is that kind of where you see that shared experience moving to, or what do you see that kind of media mix in the consumption look like over the next couple of years?
Wow. It's difficult to say. I think, you know, I think that those shared experiences around watching content, you know, like on TV. And again, we've seen those moments come back to the fore in some regards around, you know, those appointments of you, be it gladiators or traitors, you know, which have been great because they are shared experiences. I think with how I'm kind of seeing the two pieces of technology where we're investing at the minute, which is basically the Ray-Ban smart glasses, which are pretty lightweight and, you know, got an AI assistant in them. We're developing technology as and when it's ready to then be able to those to be augmented, an augmented experience. And then you've got the other side, you've got the Quest, which again is far more tech heavy, and the fidelity of the experience is far richer. But it's still quite a, you know, it's a big device that you're wearing. You're not going to walk around the streets with one of those strapped to your face. So the intersection of those two devices, be it, I don't know, 5-7 years in the future, there's going to be something quite interesting there, which is going to, I think, help augment our daily lives, either through the AI assistant or just being able to translate things or tell you where to go. All those things that we've already you know, given to our phones to help us augment our lives. You know, no one remembers phone numbers, obviously. No one, I barely know directions. I'll just rely on Google Maps for everything. You know, we've kind of given those jobs to be done to our mobile. So, you know, there's going to be more jobs that I think we can, we can leave to the AI, like to your point, what are the things you don't want to do? So that's going to happen, and that the form factor is probably going to develop where it's more usable and it's more everyday. Whether and how that disrupts kind of shared experiences around watching content together, I don't know. I think the connected TV world, which is kind of is growing, and TV becoming more personalized and addressable, I think is probably the first more immediate step that we can all probably see happening, and that's exciting. But how and where we're going to experience things together, you know, when the technology presents and we're all, you know, photorealistic avatars and we can all be in a room, even though we're not in a room together, that's interesting. But whether you then want to go and experience content together, the technology's got a long way to go, I would say, before we're kind of there.
Yeah. And kind of building on that a little bit, what are the attention metrics that you think advertisers should now be looking at? Because I think we're maybe moving away from some of the performance driven metrics as, you know, we change the way that we're going to do conversion tracking and all of these things. So I think it is, what is memorable, what is an experience, and what are the attention metrics that you think maybe are evolving slightly or we should be focusing on?
Yeah, again, it's something that we've been thinking about quite a lot over the last couple of years and trying to understand more around, you know, how to capture people's attention and how to hold it. And what does that mean for, you know, building memory structures, building short-term brand impact, and also what relationship is there to a sale as well. And this is a hideously complicated area. And I think what the industry is currently talking about is our proxies for attention. Because, you know, to hold someone's attention and to even define what attention is, be it audio or visual, that in and of itself is quite complicated. So we're using kind of eye tracking as a proxy for attention. I mean, I'm highly engaged in this conversation. My eyes are still darting around. So again, it's a proxy for someone's attention. And I think the danger, I think, from thinking or using proxies is it can slightly distract you from what you're trying to achieve for a brand. And certainly for most brands that we talk to, most are concerned about growth primarily. So how do they grow their business through more sales? And depending on the nature of the business, those sales are sometimes easier to track than others, right? So you've got a lot of the digital first e-com advertisers who are got incredibly complicated and sophisticated data and tech setups where they know pretty clearly what's driving those sales and how they can measure incrementality. But then you've got more complicated business. I mean, automotive is probably the most complicated events, movies, you know, you've got a lot of these industries where the kind of the path to purchase, for want of a better phrase, is more nuanced and happens over a lot longer period of time. So how do we kind of break up those journeys, be it buying a car, into different stages, and how do we then ingest data from those different stages, different intent, different signals back into the system so that it gives you a richer sense of where someone is on their journey to buy a car, as an example. I think the industry's interest in attention as a kind of a metric is trying to fill the hole for some of those companies, those brands who don't have access to a lot of signal and data. So I kind of get it, particularly those advertisers who want to quite rightly build their brand over the long time. So, but how do you optimize that? You know, if you don't have the data and the signals to be able to do so, then is attention the next best thing? So we're trying to explore what relationship some of those metrics have to a business outcome. Because ultimately, what we care about and what most of our clients care about is that hard business outcome. Because again, growth is on everyone's minds. But we're trying to understand what, if any, relationship there is between, you know, 1 second, 2 second, 3 seconds of attention and the business outcome, because that's the thing that's most important.
I think where we're maybe seeing a slight shift is typically clients are very focused on performance and it's maybe quite short term, a lot are within events or B2B space. And the movement and the shift that we're seeing is there's no bad spend in brand. And I think advertisers are kind of moving towards this, especially more in the B2B space. Our markets are, our audiences are only really in market for 5% of the year. So actually for that whole year, we need to be continually investing in the brand and looking at different metrics. So really all we're looking for is to be top of mind when that buyer journey actually starts. And usually the buyer's kind of made up their mind now by the time they're actually going to do their research. And it's very small decisions at that stage. So I think that's where we're seeing. And I think maybe some of this came out of cookie depreciation and moving to more, we need to be building data year round and doing that through content and investing in brand. So we've definitely seen that shift on our side, that it's okay actually to spend more top of the funnel, and how that's all shifting, because we get the payoff later and we get the growth later, but it's maybe a slightly longer term view. So we're looking over 12 months as opposed to six is probably where we're seeing that shift happen.
Yeah, I think 100% agree. And again, even some of our more performance-led advertisers are starting to, I mean, we don't use the word brand because for some businesses it's kind of anathema, but thinking about future growth, and by expanding the pool of your audience beyond who you absolutely know are interested into a much broader broader scope is again, having a short-term impact, because you can often convert those people anyway. But also is building building demand over a longer period of time as well. And to your point, you know, that kind of idea of always on throughout the year is something obviously Byron Sharp and others have long since advocated for, because most people are not in market most of the time. But you need to have some form of, like you say at the start, you know, a compelling front of mind, mental availability from consistent messaging most of the time, or as often as you can be in market. That's kind of gonna stabilize the business, and when people do go into market, you can be more sure that they're probably going to be more favorable.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I think doing all of that, being memorable and just having something emotive as your creative, testing different things. So we're testing generative AI and all of the creative, which I think at the moment it's memorable because it's different and people are curious. So I don't know how that will actually evolve over the next few years, that will start to become more common. But right now we're seeing that that's definitely giving brands a little bit of an edge, but we'll see how that goes. Mm. So in terms of, I don't know if you can speak to a little bit strategies that you're seeing working well in terms of audience building, first party data, kind of as we prepare for cookies going away, anything that you're seeing that's just a little bit different there? I think we've seen a lot of the same content building type ideas. So I'm just interested for our audience, anything else that you're seeing working well?
Yeah, and I think this is, again, one of the fundamental shifts in our story, our narrative to market, having moved from a position where there was far more data available, which we could then significantly chop and cut up into different segments of audiences. We can profile them in a richer way and then target them with different messaging. That kind of very layered approach to kind of using our platforms was kind of, you know, the last sort of 10 years. We've moved completely the other way, because one, we've obviously seen changes in the landscape, both regulatory and a kind of a platform level. There's less data around, so we've got to be more comfortable with modeling and AI, and having a much broader view of what your audience is. And this is something we're kind of trying to politely challenge clients to think about, is that whoever you think your defined audience may be, there's a chance, there's a possibility that, you know, it's much broader than that. So we're encouraging everyone to go as broad as possible. And a lot of our newer end-to-end products like Advantage Plus shopping campaigns starts with, you know, your target audience is the UK.
Yeah.
It's that big. And then let the AI and the new machine learning models understand and find your audience based on the signals we get back. And that's worked incredibly well. But that's a big change. That's a big change for clients and agencies to get their head around. It's changing from a predefined assumption of who your audience is. And again, this has always been the way in which media has been planned and bought. We think it's 18 to 34 year old men. Well, actually, is it? Why don't we just put that to the test? And again, we would always encourage any client to test their BAU approach versus a new one that we suggest. We never ask people to take our word for it. We would always just say, look, let's test it. Let's see what works best. So from a targeting point of view, we're encouraging everyone to go as broad as possible and let the AI find the right audience based on whatever your objective is, be it a performance or a brand one. I think your point around creative then becomes even more important, right? So, and we talk about creative being the new targeting. So how do you set up with the right creative strategy in order to meet those audiences who are going to be very broad in terms of the targeting? So how do you predefine kind of different iterations of that? And that's where Gen AI can be incredibly helpful, because it can shortcut a lot of the cost around developing a load of different assets, because it can make different versions of your core asset. Again, all within guidelines, all within the color palette and the copy type that may be super important to that brand. So we're still very early in this journey around how we can figure out the right layers of creative to feed that automated system. And that's what I was saying before. This is a journey that, again, clients and agencies are particularly agencies, I would say, are well positioned to have a view on, because they've got a view of the market or an industry or multiple industries to be able to learn at scale. And that's something that I guess we're quite excited about, because it puts more control and a different challenge around creative in the hands of marketers to then feed into this automated world. So there's loads of which we don't yet know and don't yet have a point of view on, but we're starting to do some interesting testing.
Yeah, I can speak firsthand to using the Advantage Plus targeting and creative development. It's been, the data has just been phenomenal that's come out of it, but it's a huge mindset shift. So it's kind of like you say, the data's there, but do we trust the data? Because we don't quite have the story. And well, we've always done it like we have our personas and we put job title targeting and all the stuff we used to be able to do. Well, actually, let's not put CFO as a job title. Let's see who behaves like a CFO and pick up 5,000 different data points. And it's actually our behavior speaks much more than these predefined categories, which is the way that all of the targeting is now evolved. But it's kind of like giving up a little bit of that control, but the offset is the performance is better and the scalability is there, and you can test, you know, you're testing thousands of variations as opposed to doing very kind of granular A/B testing that's hugely time consuming. So I think it's more of a mindset for us and for our clients, but once you've got that data and you can tell the story, everybody gets on board really, really quickly. And it's the same, you know, some of the, you know, the different types of campaigns that we've seen on Google and LinkedIn at the beginning, there's a little bit of fear, but, you know, once you see the data, it works very well.
Yeah. And I think, again, you are, it's a mindset. It's a paradigm shift really, because if this continues the way it is and it kind of scales across all media, it kind of turns some of the tenets of, like, you know, how we plan and about media on its head a little bit, because it removes this kind of pre assumptions around who and where to target, because it kind of cedes control to the AI and this kind of black box that people often don't understand. So there's a major change that I think we're in the middle of. And to your other point of the question as well, is that, you know, in a world where there is just less data and obviously cookies moving on, the need to kind of really strengthen the data where it is available and to ensure it's of a high fidelity through things like the Conversions API, which we encourage clients to adopt, which is a server-to-server integration, which doesn't rely on cookies, that becomes increasingly more important. And again, if you're dealing with, I don't know, 20% of the data that you used to have, but it's incredibly rich and can draw on segmentation of value across different customer bases, that's the special source that you as a client can leverage to understand and then set up different bids around, or different complex strategies to augment the system that's going to be automated. So that there's still, again, huge work to be done in just ensuring you've got the right data connected to the system, which, again, it's not always easy to do, because there's lots of consent issues, there's lots of things to consider around how and why you can use data. But once you've got through those hurdles, there's massive gains to be made.
Yeah, we've seen the data coming out of Convergence API and doing server-side tracking, and it's great. I think my question is, how many clients or advertisers are realistically going to do that? Because there is a decent amount of technical implementation, then there's ongoing cost, then it's just even kind of knowing that's what you need to do. So we do, yeah, maybe 2,000 events a year. I'm not sure how many clients will go through that pain and cost. Well, that's yet to be seen, because it's a mindset shift. Probably over time, when they don't have the data and you maybe feel the pain, then you say, okay, we need to go do this. But do you have any steer on uptake on Convergence API, or where do you think that'll head as a performance kind of number?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, because I mean, we work with a lot of clients based out of London, many of whom are performance advertisers, many of them are big clients, and we've been talking to them about the Convergence API for like 3 or 4 years. But because the goalposts have kind of been moving in terms of when things will really be turned off, the urgency hasn't been there. So the ones who are, you know, really elite level, they've been on it for a couple of years, and they're seeing the performance gains. They're seeing, you know, it's not even just Convergence API for web, it's offline conversions as well. I mean, that's where you really get to some interesting understanding of your audience, is when you can understand and optimize then towards an offline sale as well as an online one. That's, you know, that would be the nirvana, and understand the incrementality of those audiences, the lifetime value of them. I guess to your point though, is, you know, we are in a fortunate position as a business globally to have many smaller advertisers and businesses rely on ourselves and others to drive business. You know, I work with some of people I know have got small businesses to help them use the platform. You know, if you're a landscape gardener, you're not going to install the Convergence API for your event. So for those, we're kind of helping people, you know, develop a shop or a way of operating that's within the ecosystem as well. So obviously Convergence API solves for kind of like website, but we've seen certainly in other developing markets, like WhatsApp is the home of business, because that's where businesses are run from. Websites are just not as reliant in certain markets. So how can we develop a place for businesses that can operate just within our ecosystem? Obviously that would be, you know, that's got benefits to us, but it's got benefits to them as well, because it doesn't then rely on the wider changes to the landscape. So if you've got a shop that you can run on Instagram or Facebook, or even have a business page within WhatsApp and run transactions within that part of the ecosystem, again, even within our own platforms, it's not always complicated to stitch the things together, but that's a viable alternative to help people be in control of their data and understand what's working and what's not.
Yeah, that's true. And you've got like native lead gen, for instance, or there's messaging, or there is these other ways that you don't need kind of technical knowledge to do that, which I think is really interesting. And yeah, we have clients in the Middle East, and they will only communicate with us on WhatsApp. It's just like, we will do full enormous projects over WhatsApp, and that includes procurement teams, CMOs. Just it's just a cultural way of doing business. So yeah, you're right, you've got those much easier ways of doing tracking, which I think is giving options rather than the technical side. So yeah, but definitely we've seen the richness in the data, and it's you know, you get the payoff, I think, if you invest the time and the energy to do that. But we felt the same, you know these things are coming, but it's only now that we've actually started to see audiences decline. So maybe 10-20%, we're starting to see that actually happen. And I'd say it's only now when it's really happening, like we saw maybe with J4 last year, when it actually happened, everyone starts paying attention, which I think is just human nature. We're like,
of course,
last minute people somehow, there's so many pressures on our time that we'll prioritize it when it really is an issue. So it's nice to be ahead of a few things, but the majority, I think, are still
last
minute.
It's got to move into the urgent and important box.
Yeah, it does. It's going crying baby.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I've got huge empathy, because, you know, everyone's got their own priorities as a business. You know, we're one of many different platforms. You know, everyone's probably asking for the exact same thing. How do you prioritize that? How does that sit within your general tech stack and development roadmap? You know, these things are not easy to do, but for those who are doing it, we're seeing the gain. So I still think there's it's going to be ROI positive for the costs involved.
Yeah, I think so. And I actually think around that, it's the storytelling that has made a difference of getting people to pay attention. So we're talking about cookie depreciation. It's not the sexiest of topics and it's really hard to get everyone to care. But when you say, okay, we're actually losing this audience now, everyone's like, okay, what do we need to do? How do we build the data and give it the energy that it deserves? So it just needs a bit of rebranding, I think, maybe give it a bit of a snazzier title.
Maybe that's what we need to do. Yeah, capping is just not that sexy.
Yeah, it's not.
Think about that.
Amazing. Okay, so just coming to a close, can you tell us about any advice that you got earlier in your career that you still hold dear today and you've maybe shared with others as you've gone through? I'm always interested in these origins of advice.
Yeah, it's a good one. So I think some of the advice that I remember and I kind of still hold dear is the importance of having a plan and a really clear plan. Because, you know, you get to the end of any period, give it 6 months, a year, you know, how do you know whether you've really been successful? There's so many things that can contribute towards success. And look, you know, I'm a big believer that luck plays a big role in anyone's career, anyone's, you know, business, right time, right place, all that sort of stuff. But having a clear plan and being very intentional about what you want to achieve and obviously knowing how to measure it is always struck with me. I think we've worked with a company called Fast Forward, who do a training called vision writing, which I've actually been trained to deliver as well. And that whole idea is like to fast forward to the end of the year and write down what you've achieved as if it's already happened. And that's always been a very powerful thing for me to think about. Is one, to be very clear about what you want to achieve, both personally and professionally, and then to write it down as if it's already happened, and then to share it with people. It's just a really simple way of kind of creating a moment and defining it with language that is meaningful to you, and then telling people about it is just, I've seen the impact personally and with other people. It's just, it can be quite transformative. That idea of just sharing what's important and enlisting others in that journey, I think is just amazing when it works. I think the other thing, which I guess it's more of an observation rather than advice, is just the importance of curiosity and just never to stop learning. It's something that again fuels me here working at Meta, because there's always something. There's always many, many things that we're working on, which are net new and many of which I don't understand yet, but that kind of is energizing to learn about them. But having the curiosity to actually care and go out and be uncomfortable around topics and learn about them, I think is I've always enjoyed and always enjoyed in others as well, those who are curious. So just asking questions, not being afraid to ask what might appear to be silly questions as well. But I think there's not that many silly questions in marketing. And tech certainly, because, you know, there's a lot of received wisdom out there and often some of that needs to be updated as well.
I love that. Thanks for sharing. So yeah, infinite learner mindset and writing down the plan, I think is key. I've heard that if you write stuff down, your brain can't always actually differentiate that it's not real. So if you write it down, your brain you can kind of trick your brain into thinking it's real. So I think that's great advice. So thanks so much for sharing. And thank you for all of your insights, Rob. You are super smart and that was just a fascinating conversation. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. And we'll post all your links with the
podcast.
Not at all.
It's been great. It's been a great chat. And thank you for having me.
Thanks, Rob.
Cheers.